It's 40 years since Iran's Islamic Revolution. Today, it's under huge economic pressure. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Anu Anand. Good morning. First, U.S.-China trade talks restarted in Beijing today. March 2nd is the deadline for a new round of U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods. Julian Evans-Pritchard is China economist for Capital Economics in Singapore.
I think for China, a win would be something that averts further U.S. tariffs and ideally, you know, reverses some of the tariffs that, Trump has already put in place, perhaps offering concessions of the kind that they already intended to do anyway. So one example would be to reduce some of the restrictions on foreign investment into China. There's also a draft intellectual property protection law, which introduces stricter enforcement and punishment for those violations. From the US perspective, Trump's obviously banged on about the trade deficit. That's one reason why, as part of the concessions that China's offering, is to purchase more US goods. And that is an area where we are seeing progress, and they've already resumed purchases of oil and soybeans. The more difficult one is intellectual property protection, industrial policy, and just the feeling that the playing field is not level between the countries.
I wonder how much pressure there is now on China. You mentioned those domestic headwinds. If you look at consumer sentiment at the moment, there's been this week-long celebration of Lunar New Year, typically a big opportunity for spending, and demand there has been a bit weak. I mean, is there any sign that China is going to blink?
I don't think that we've reached the point where the government in China is so concerned that they're willing to do anything to avert further tariffs. The reality is that although these tariffs are putting additional pressure on China's economy, the main drag is actually domestic, and in particular some of the policy tightening that the central bank did over the past couple of years and regulatory tightening.
Julian Evans-Pritchard there. Let's do the numbers. As those talks kick off, it's the first day of trading for Chinese stocks after a week off to celebrate the Lunar New Year. Shares in Hong Kong rose, with European stocks following suit. The UK's FTSE 100 is up more than 1% despite fresh data showing the economy grew at its slowest pace since 2012. Now, 40 years ago today, on February 11th, 1979, revolutionaries overthrew Iran's monarchy. And on that day, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini declared Iran an Islamic Republic. Well, today, Tehran is facing unprecedented economic pressure from U.S. sanctions imposed for its involvement in Middle Eastern conflicts and President Trump pulling out of the nuclear treaty. Nargis Bajogli of Johns Hopkins University regularly visits Iran. She describes the impact of sanctions.
When you go grocery shopping, the price of everything has gone up at least 4 to 5-fold. You know, you used to be able to, let's say, buy a kilo of meat for $10, now multiply that by 4 times. These are really, you know, difficult, especially for families. Within the rural areas, there just isn't as much opportunity as there are in some of the urban areas. It's much harder to find jobs that pay or jobs at all. That just adds to the dire economic circumstances. The demographic reality of Iran is that the vast majority of the population is young and doesn't remember the revolution. So what that means is that the government has to deal with that reality of how, if it wants to sustain itself, if it wants to continue as the government that came out of the revolution, then it really needs to think about, and it has been thinking about, how, if at all, it can reform itself to meet the needs of this younger population. So far, at least, I mean, things in society change all the time, but so far, and from all the evidence we've seen, even young people in Iran don't want another revolution. And they do want significant reforms, but they don't want a revolution because they've experienced the afterlife of one revolution and they're not sure that they want to experience another one. But what that means is that they've been pushing for significant reforms for a very long time.
Nargis Bajogli. Horse racing has a long, distinguished history here in Britain. Now, it was established more than 2,000 years ago during Roman times. Today, it's the second largest spectator sport in Britain, and it earns $4.5 billion for the British economy. This week, though, racing is on hold as thousands of animals are tested for horse flu. The BBC's Cornelius Lysatt is following the story.
Equine influenza is actually endemic in the horse population. And although it is likely in any racing stable there might be one or two that are suffering, this is a particularly nasty bout. And what the racing authorities in the UK are keen not to happen is for it to spread amongst the many thousands of racehorses around the country, and indeed not spread abroad to Ireland and France.
How much of a disruption is this to the racing calendar?
Well, there's been no racing in Britain since Thursday, and we know that racing won't be resuming before Wednesday. There are 174 racing stables around the UK which are in isolation at the moment. No horse movements in or out, and horses within them are being tested. No action for the betting industry. On the other hand, if this hiatus turns out to just be 6 days, it's something that the sport will be able to deal with. The biggest week of the year is the Cheltenham Festival, which takes place from March the 12th for 4 days. That's a huge week. So now that's a month away. And although there's no suggestion of a threat at this stage to Cheltenham, there's a certain amount of nerves.
Cornelius, I think this is the first ever interview I've done on horse racing. We don't get to talk about it much. It is also popular in the US, but how is it different between the two countries?
Kentucky Derby, Preakness Stakes and Belmont Stakes, of course, making up the US Triple Crown, one of the absolutely iconic events in world sport. The main difference, I suppose, would be in the UK, if you go to a race course, you can bet in terms of pool betting. Also, you actually have people standing on boxes shouting odds to try and attract the customers. You have the pool betting in the US, but you don't have bookmakers standing up and shouting the odds in quite the same way.
Cornelius Lysette in London. I'm Anu Anand with the Marketplace Morning Report, coming to you live from the BBC World Service.